Hi, everybody. Welcome to Outrageous, our weekly podcast about media, culture, power, politics, and everything in between. I'm joined once again by my two very best friends, Jason, an avid vegetarian from D.C.
A pescatarian now.
And tennis / fiction queen, Trisha, out in L.A.
Hello.
Are you fiction queen now? What does that mean, fiction queen?
I have no idea.
Tennis slash fiction. Our first topic will be slash fiction.
No. Oh, dear.
how are you guys doing tonight?
Pretty good, actually. It's been a good week. I've been watching the Republican Party implode.
Oh, my God.
Or not really.
You know what I like? I like that every conversation I have cannot get, like, 10 feet into it without someone mentioning Donald Trump.
I like that foreigners come up to me and ask me, does he seriously have a chance of winning this election? I'm like, I don't know.
I like he's propelling. Foreigners are, like, rooting for Hillary, which is, like, I'm always like, I don't know who is the head of the government of your country. Like, I don't, how are you so involved in it? Like, I have friends on Facebook from, like, Italy and Germany being like, will Bernie get enough delegates? I'm like, how do you know about delegates? What?
I bet you they know more than most. No one understands.
You're
delegates.
Like, what continent is your country on again?
I know. I'm like,
is that a country or a continent?
I'm like, Germany, Angela Merkel, done. That's how much I know about your
government.
That's
about it. That's about it. She's like the only one I know. Isn't that horrible?
Meanwhile, they're fretting about super delegates, and I'm like, okay.
Yay for American political system. It's because it's just the longest.
especially although the Italians have had some pretty raucous elections, what with their porn stars running and
But I think Iran, they said it was like an 8-day campaign.
God, can you imagine having something that brief? Could we make a decision that quickly about anything?
Don't they just tell those people how to vote anyway?
Like, oh my God, vote, so ignorant.
Voter else. What? I don't mean to be ignorant. I'm just saying, like, you know.
Everyone's thinking, Christopher?
No, that would be Trump. Trump is saying, apparently Donald Trump is saying what everyone's thinking. And then he says stuff, and I'm like, I wasn't thinking that. But, yeah. But apparently the majority of the country is.
Not the majority. Let's be careful. It is not the majority.
It's not the majority. Poor America. We're all going to hell in a handbasket. And I think that's a great way to start off tonight.
Okay.
How everything is just doomed to hell.
Well, my topic is about that. You don't have to start with me, but this is a good segue, I just want to say.
Well, wouldn't it be weird if we didn't start with you now? So let's just move into the topics. Jason, what are you talking about?
You
could
be like, fuck you.
Ow! It got intense. It's like Deadpool.
I heard this story today on NPR about the fact that they had interviews with several evangelical leaders who are really, really upset that not only Trump is doing as well as he is, but that many of, like, members of their congregations, member of their evangelical networks are supporting Trump. And I heard, you know, they had these interviews where I heard, you know, right-wing evangelicals saying Christ preached love and unity and not, you know, you don't hate. This is the question it raised for me that I want to pose to the two of you. Is it possible that what you said, Trisha, about the Republican Party imploding, or I would say it this way, particularly around this story, this longstanding coalition among fiscal conservatives, you know, right-wing evangelicals, and, you know, Tea Party, no taxes, you know, underlying racism, that coalition, that Trump's rise is so divisive to the right that in the long term it might be good for our country because there are useful divisions where people like evangelicals are saying, wait a second, if this movement is leading to you know, things that we deem as anti-Christian, like racism and hatred and bigotry and xenophobia. Like, might that be good for America in the long run? Is there any way that Trump's rise in the long run is going to be good for America for that reason?
Well, I will say initially, I thought that Trump's rise was good for America because I did think that it was going to lead to a fracturing of groups that probably didn't belong together or at least had soured. The only part of it that became scary was when I started to see that he might actually emerge as the nominee. Like, I didn't think that he would get this far. I thought that sort of traditional party conventions would have figured out a way to get rid of him. I really thought he would just do damage to the party, and that while confusion reigned, the Democrats would sort of slip in and have two more terms. That's what I really thought was going to happen.
Wow.
No, I mean, that was just what I thought until that party got itself together, maybe for another couple cycles even. Because this is a realignment of that party, right? That party realigned towards towards the evangelical crowd. Wasn't that in the 70s? Isn't that the 70s when that
I think 80s was like the Christian coalition.
Christian coalition entered it in the 80s, but prior to that, there was a kind of taking over of kind of like these southern kind of Dixie-ist kind of notion. So
I don't remember the history well enough to
What do they call those folks? The ones from the woods, the wood republic.
Rednecks?
Something. No, it was a group. It was a group, and they really started moving. I think they started moving the Republican Party away from sort of hyper concentration on fiscal issues and more around sort of ideological issues. That group. So I really thought that this was a welcome change and a welcome move away from that, but. So that's my serious take on the issue initially, Jason. But then my not-so-serious take was I started laughing because I'm like, did evangelicals not know that people thought they were racist? Like, how are they so self-unaware? Do they really think that people did? Like, if when I hear evangelical, short word in my mind is potential racist.
Right. But, I agree with you. And what I think might be happening, and I don't want to overstate it, it may be, though, when the racism is now so manifest that it is actually causing a conflict for them between their Christianity and their racism. That would be – I'm being very optimistic, but that is what I'm wondering. Is that potentially happening and could lead that whole block – not the whole block, but many members of that block – to actually realize it now that it's manifest and distance themselves both politically and hopefully kind of consciously from from racism.
I have a point, but I'll let Chris finish.
I'm going to say no. Thank you very much, Kanye West. Anyway, as I was saying.
No. I was going to make another point that, Christians didn't seem to have a problem with slavery for years. So.
I was just, stop stealing my points. This is like the
Trisha
show.
God told us to have slaves. It's in the Bible.
Exactly.
I think, I don't know, Jason. I think your question is pretty hopeful, right? Because that's your hope. Like, I think it's an interesting thought experiment to think that by exposing aspects of the underbelly of the Republican Party as racist, I think it's hopeful to think that it's going to wake up Christians in this way. I'm reflecting back on, I had said this the other day. It sort of slipped out. It slipped out before, but I was describing someone to a friend. And I was like, they're like super Christian. They're like super Christian, but they're a good person. As if to say, oh,
so sad.
Because you have to do that, especially because as a gay person, and my friends are gay. The person I was talking to was gay. I was like, no, they're super Christian, but don't worry, they're not evil, which seems like a terrible thing to have to put out there.
But that's what happened to Christianity.
All of this to say, Jason, I think what you're proposing is a really hopeful kind of stance. What's going to happen in reality? There's a lot going on. American politics has really moved away from the practical and towards the ideological. Now you'll find that these people, these talking heads on television and the candidates themselves are talking about ideological issues of which they can influence for sure – but it's not going to influence the lives of people every day. You know, we talk a lot about religion's place in governmental buildings as far as like prayer in schools, or we talk about gay marriage or abortion, and these things that are not as important to every single American, such as health care or the economy or other things along that bent, like more universal things. And that's not an accident, right? Like, again, the history, I don't want to go on record and sound like an idiot because I don't remember enough of the history, but there was a moment when the Republicans made that decision that they were going to make ideological arguments. And they've been very successful, and they're not going to stop. And like Trisha said, not for nothing, but the Christians were fine with slavery. They were fine with Jim Crow. They were fine with segregation. They've been fine all the way up to present day. They're fine with whatever they're given. And I'd like to say that I'd like to say that, oh, this is going to be the moment where they choose Jesus. But to be fair, and people listening to this might be offended, but to be fair, they haven't really chosen Jesus up until now. Because if they did, they wouldn't have aligned with the Republican Party in the first place.
Well, I mean, they would have aligned with the Republic. I mean, this is interesting because there was a time when I think we talked about this offline, maybe last year. We talked about how there were certain places where there was room for the Democratic Party to actually engage in moral conversations that they had sort of abandoned to the Republicans. Because I think part of the problem was that maybe they felt like the Republican Party was the only place for them because we sort of explicitly spoke about Christ or all the other things, right? Or Christianity in general. I just don't think that people felt like there was room for those kinds of words or phrases in the Democratic Party.
That's
because
right.
We're talking about abortion, right? Remember we were talking about that sort of space had been abandoned in some ways by Democrats and that there was actually room for them to reclaim it. You know, reclaim it in a sort of in a kind of public forum where you can talk about religiosity, spirituality, all of those things, even as you're trying to make sure that people maintain their rights. I think that's always been the tension for Christians is, you know, abortion becomes one of their sort of like linchpin points. And then if you're a liberal, then suddenly you have no room to stand on because suddenly you support killing babies. You know, so it's just like these weird kind of extensions of that became a space where suddenly Democratic Party wasn't a place for those kinds of questions about right to life and all of that issue. And so I think they just fell into that group. Maybe it was never natural, though. Maybe it was just convenient.
I think that's right. I agree.
So I don't know if I'm as hopeful as Jason. I do think the party's going to splinter, though. I
can't believe it didn't already. I can't believe it did during the McCain-Palin nonsense.
No, that was the start of it. I mean, essentially, McCain-Palin set the ground. Everyone has sort of been blaming Obama for this, but it's really them. I mean, they've essentially sort of created this. They've sort of set the seed for this. This is them reaping what they've sown for the last 8 years. They've frightened people. They've convinced people that the world is going to hell in a handbasket, that Obama is taking the country backwards into I don't know where. I mean, they've really sort of frightened their entire constituents. And now that their constituents are necessarily frightened for the last 8 years, or the last seven, have they? It was always, let's be anti this. Well, if you've just emphasized being anti something for 7 to 8 years, how are you going to get someone on to something positive and affirming? That's always just been my practical confusion. Like, you know, so here comes a candidate who says I'm anti everyone. I want a bridge. I want to get rid of this person. You know what I mean? So it was like, hello, here's the avatar of everything we've spoken about for the last 7 years.
I wonder where Trump is going because he's gotten this far with no policy.
Yeah.
He has no policy idea.
Yeah.
Think about how hard Hillary must have worked to get all of her shit together. And at the end of the day, you don't really need any of that. I wonder where it's going and I wonder how it's going to end. He won't be president.
Let's hope.
He won't be president.
I'm not going on wood.
I just wonder how far he can take it. Now I'm sort of like less hysterical about the rise, about his rise, and just more like pensive. Like, how far will America tolerate this? You know, when he refused to condemn David Duke and the KKK on air on CNN, that was like a wake-up call for me. That's when I sort of like slowed down.
And for some.
Like,
and for some.
Well, it made me slow down and be like, okay, he's not, like, this is not a serious thing. Like, he's like, he's not even dog whistling. Like, it's not even like the politics of old. It's this new thing that he's doing where he wants to get as many clicks and as many eyeballs, and it doesn't even matter. But at some point, it's got to. It just has to. America won't let this happen.
Well, can we roll back around to your question, though, Jason? Where do you think the evangelicals will go now? Like, do you think they will, I mean, this group that's been sort of alert and awakened, where are they going?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. And your question, you know, is a question for all the blocks of the Republican Party, right? Like, the way things are headed, I think we're all in agreement that Trump's likely not to win. That's going to piss off a lot of Republicans. So you're going to have the Trump bloc that's going to become disillusioned with the party. I think you have the Tea Party, which is already pissed with the party, right? I mean, Ted Cruz represents – yeah. I mean, Ted Cruz represents this bloc. Well, I mean, he's evangelical. But there's also – you know, there's just this whole Tea Party bloc that are like, they're not really fighting for us. No one is happy with the Republican establishment. So I think – I don't know the answer to your question, but this is the existential question for the party. What I will say, there's an opportunity here, and I'm not – you know, it's not easy to take advantage of. But if you look at – and we talked about this a little bit in a previous conversation. If you look at Sanders and Trump, in both cases, they are appealing to working class white people who feel left out of the economy. Like that, and it's just a different message for each. Trump is saying it's the Muslims' fault and it's Hispanics' fault, so let's go after them. Sanders is saying it's the banks' fault, it's Hillary Clinton's fault, let's go after them. And in an ideal world, someone would find a way to stitch those both sides together toward a common, I hate to use the word enemy, but to say, you know, it is the economic system, and let's organize to change that, not make it so personal that it's this group of people or that group of people. If someone could thread that needle, I think there'd be an incredible populist opportunity.
Yeah, I was thinking about that today. I was thinking that in some ways, if you wanted to actually move people in a direction, I mean, and listen, I loathe to even mention this out loud, but I will. I did sort of think to myself that Bernie Sanders has a moment, because also, you know, part of the rise of Trump is also sort of like an anti-Hillary thing too, right? They're anti her.
Sure.
She activates people. So if people don't know where to go, I mean, Sanders has a space that he could occupy. I just don't know if he's – I don't know if his group is sort of clever enough to figure that out, because I have to say he's not been clever about figuring out how to get the black vote. Whew. So
– no, he's utterly failed.
Yeah. Dismal at that.
Yeah, it turns out for Clinton in record numbers. She got more black votes down south than Obama did in 2008.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, in 2008, they were probably conflicted, right? They were like, ooh, Clinton, Obama. But this time around, there was no conflict. It wasn't even a competition.
Well, it's also, yeah, that's right. And the unions were supporting Clinton. And so the unions have a lot of black membership. I mean, I had this conversation with one of the leaders of the Baltimore Teachers Union, who is African-American, has been a civil rights activist, and she was a delegate. She went for Clinton in 2008. So I think that was part of it. There were just organized groups that were going to go for Clinton, even though Obama was capturing the larger numbers in the end.
Yeah.
To roll around to your question, I wondered this during the McCain-Palin fiasco, there is a political party, the Conservative Party, right, that's not the Republican Party.
Yeah.
I just don't know why one of those aren't shored up by these Christians, you know? I was...
But I think they weren't recruited. But I think they could be. Hmm. You know, it's like what happened with after Nader. You know, that little bit of a bump of the Green Party, a little bit of a bump of the Libertarians, whatever. But I mean, I think the far right did a good job of shoring everyone up under the umbrella of the Republican Party, which is why now they're realizing, shit, we don't all belong to under this tent.
Right. Yeah.
But where do you go? We spent a lot of time building up just two parties, and so they've becoming more and more polarized to the point where, and this is where Trump is a fantastic performance artist, right? He's pushed the Republicans so far to the right that it's become ludicrous, you know. And the Democrats don't even have to respond, because usually that's what happens, right? They both like move to their opposite corners, and then as we get closer to the election, they both try and approach the middle. But now Trump's gone so far to the right that that doesn't have to be engaged in. Hillary just has to hold her ground.
Exactly, yeah, that's what she's doing.
That's all she's doing.
Let me get rid of Bernie, and I'll smoke Trump. I don't have to say a word.
Yeah, she doesn't have to tack moderate or right. She just stands exactly where she is. Or tack moderate. Just tack sensible, really.
Although poor Bernie, though, I don't know. I mean, he's not out of this. This is, I mean, Super Tuesday's up, and he won more seats than I gave him credit for. So this is still, I mean, it's still a ride.
He won one, didn't he?
No, he won four.
No.
Oh, okay.
He won Minnesota, he won Vermont, he won Colorado, and he won somewhere else.
He won for Oklahoma, but...
Oklahoma, yeah.
But the numbers, the delegate numbers...
Not the super delegate.
It's near impossible.
Not the super delegate.
My understanding is her numbers are way ahead of his.
Her numbers are, and I think... For all practical purposes, the campaign has sort of decided. However, remember, they're running on the idea of a revolution. So they want a revolution. Do you know what I mean? They want, just like what happened in the Democratic with the VP leaving that party, they want something to happen at the convention. They want to fight at the convention. They want to say that this is a populist platform now, not just big money.
American politics seems so... it just seems so silly. I mean, strike that. Not silly.
I think it's
but,
silly.
Like, the drama that's involved in the back and the forth. And
Because it's non-parliamentary, right? Otherwise, we just give percentages. Isn't that how that works in other places?
Yeah. It's reality TV. That's why Trump's doing so well.
but if it was straight reality TV, it'd be like, you know, I'm sorry, Bernie, you're not getting a rose or a pearl necklace or whatever. And he would just exit. Like, it wouldn't be like this long.
No, but this one is not like that show. It's like, what was the one with the black couple with New York where they just start fighting?
Flavor of love.
This, unfortunately, is a Flavor of Love episode. And Bernie people are going to have a battle till the bitter end.
No clock for you.
Yes, and they're like, you didn't give me a rose? Let's have a conversation about this.
Let's have a conversation.
I'm going to spit on you.
Let's fight, yes.
We've been relatively smug, but the reality is the same thing could happen to the Democratic Party.
I totally agree.
We could
be headed towards that. I think it'll take. Do you think we could be headed towards it?
I disagree.
You don't think the Democratic Party is going to splinter at some point? It's in the cards.
But I don't think the Democratic Party can. I strike that. I don't think the Democratic Party will. Given what's going on in the Republican Party. The Republican Party has been dying a very slow death since 2008. And now Trump, with all his theatrics, has accelerated that. So the Democrats, we don't have time. Democrats don't have time to splinter because every seat in government is about to open up to Democrats because the Republican platform has become untenable. There's no time for a splintering. Maybe in the future, once there's the playing field looks different, but like you don't, you know, your team doesn't start fighting when the other team is melting down.
Tell that to Bernie supporters who say that if Bernie doesn't get the election, they're going to vote for Trump.
They're not. You know what? That's like a very, what are they, 14 years old? Like, that's ridiculous. No one's doing that.
There are some that say that on both sides. There are Trump supporters that say it about Bernie.
Yep. It's that interesting.
If Trump doesn't get the nomination, they're going to vote for Bernie?
Yes. Because they just want someone who's angry and outside the establishment. A lot of people think that's their thing.
Sorry. I don't buy it.
Chris doesn't believe in chaos.
No, I mean, I just, you know what, that, for those people to organize in those kinds of numbers to actually push the election would actually signal that they were serious about something. Yeah. It's not possible. If you were so fickle about your ideology, you wouldn't even be passionate enough to make that statement. Like, you have no rock to stand on. If the person I like doesn't win, I will completely flip on what I believe and vote for the other guy who will take us 4 years into what I didn't want 10 minutes ago.
Well, except, you know, though, Chris, the thing is, though, what you're describing, that is Trump. I don't know if you guys saw the John Oliver Sunday about Trump.
Can we give him props for actually doing what news organizations should have been doing all along?
Yes, we can. But what he pointed out, which is right, as you both have acknowledged, Trump does not have policy positions. It's not just that he doesn't, it's that he flip-flops. I mean, we used to talk about Romney being a flip-flopper. He sounded like a sincere flip-flopper. Trump, like, if we try to read everything he said and put together even the most vague approach to governance, you couldn't do it. It's all over the place. So I don't know, Chris. Like, I think there's validity what you're saying. At the same time, he's so fickle. The fact that he has 40% of the Republican Party means a lot of them are fickle. They don't have policy positions. They don't know the damn difference between, like, you know, whether we deport 11 million Hispanics or whether we have them all come work for us. Like, it's like there's no difference between the two things.
They're mixed bag.
We'll see. We'll see. You know, it's easy now to be all excited about these ideas, but you got to get to the polls. You have to want to show up and vote, and when you're faced with it, I just wonder what people are going to do. In closing up this topic, I just want to say one thing. I'm always surprised by people who are like, I don't know who I'm going to vote for yet. Like, oh, I'll make the election day. And I'm like, I'm sorry, you don't have enough information already. In America, they run for office like 2 years out. How do you not have enough information? What's more, we don't have a lot of candidates, and their positions are usually diametrically opposed. Like, what are you considering?
Well, you know, a miracle can happen.
But you're contradicting yourself, Chris, because this is, yes, people are fickle. Because they don't pay attention and they don't think much about it. I think they are that fickle.
But you don't want someone thoughtful.
No one is okay. Sorry, Trisha. No one is going Trump or Hillary. Who do I want to vote for? I don't know. They both look good. I'll have to wait till election day to figure out. No one is doing that. If you vote for Trump, it's because that appeals to you. If you vote for Hillary, either that appeals to you, which is surprising. Or Trump doesn't. Like, it's, I don't know. Maybe my calculus is off. It seems odd to me that
if I'm not mistaken, I don't have the research in front of me. I do think there's research that people vote for the last name they saw before they go into the booth.
Oh, dear.
Not everybody,
Lord.
But there are people who
do that. Lord. Then we got to get that going.
I refuse to believe that.
Oh, man.
Woo. That's why everyone puts up all those signs at the election booth. They're trying to get their sign to be the last one they see. That's why people get in trouble for like putting it.
That's why where you're not supposed to. Bill Clinton showed up at polling places. Did you read about that? You like broke some rules. All right, so let's slide out of Trump ill and slide into Trisha's topic. Trisha. Yeah. Where are you taking us?
I'm taking you to a place we like to visit called Blackface.
Blackface. Well,
Blackface land.
Yeah, we went there.
This is going to get ugly, I can tell.
It's going to get very ugly. No, so, okay, so this is, I think we flirted with this topic a while back, but I think it's gotten new life this week because scenes from the upcoming Nina Simone movie has made the rounds on the internet. It's got previews and it stars a very lovely actress who has not been afraid of claiming her Afro-Latina heritage at all, Zoe Saldana. And I've always appreciated that about Zoe Saldana. You know, she's not one of those people who, you know, she could get up there and she's like, oh no, I'm this and that. And, no, she calls herself a black actress, which is, you know, really great. However, Zoe Saldana, I think, has crossed over into a zone that I don't think she intended, and woe to Zoe. She has decided to take on the role of Nina Simone, and the first few scenes show that she has had her skin darkened by makeup, and she's added a prosthetic nose, and then necessarily has had to have a wig, but that's kind of a given, in order to play Nina Simone. And the world is not having it. Not having it at all. Some people have gone as far as calling it blackface, which traditionally doesn't really work that way because blackface is usually a white person putting on makeup to look black and then sort of doing a trope. So what do you all
think? I was going to ask, is this brown washing? We use the term whitewashing. Is this brown washing? Is that what this is happening?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and you know what? I mean, I think, so I'm trying to, you know, we had a discussion a while back about, well, you know, everyone should feel free as an artist to do any part. But this doesn't seem to work for me.
Okay.
Can I just point out, we had a previous conversation about whitewashing, and we specifically talked about Elizabeth Taylor as Cleopatra. I was doing some research on this topic since you brought it up. I mean, I was aware of it, but I wanted to read more. And I think the most disappointing part for me was that Saldana herself, in an InStyle quote, said, and I quote, I don't think Elizabeth Taylor was right for Cleopatra either. An artist is colorless, genderless.
What the hell does that mean? What the hell is that?
What
is this? Oh my god.
Wait.
I was so disappointed.
No, what is that?
That what she's using to justify is like, well, yeah, I'm not right for this part, but neither was Elizabeth Taylor for Cleopatra. So, I mean, artists are colorless and genderless, so it's all good. I was very disappointed by it because I think people have been rough against her. Like, this is not just a Zoe issue. Like, she didn't, like, storm into a room and say, I have to play this part. She was cast. It's a movie that's being, you know, produced by a black production company. So it's not, this is not just her, but that people have been vicious towards her.
Yeah, she's gotten
she had
a
that
lot of
quote.
It.
But then she had that quote, and I was like, what? Like, Zoe, okay. Come on, you're
Wait.
Making this too easy.
Wait a minute, everybody. Everyone just stop, because I have questions.
What are your questions?
I have questions. So what do we want to see in these kinds of biographical stories? Like, how do we want this to – let me just play this out for you, because I feel like this comes up a lot. So – we had a conversation, I had a conversation, you guys weren't there. I had a conversation with some people about colorblind casting and just diversity of roles. And there was a show on TV that I really enjoyed called Ascension. I think it had like one season. It was kind of cool. And I don't want to give anything away for the show because it's pretty cool. But most of the roles were sort of cast colorblind. It's sort of a period piece, like in a way, but there were black actors throughout, and no one really reacted to them as black actors in this particular period of time, which I think was like around the 60s, because the idea was that the race of them didn't really matter, the race of the character didn't really matter, they were just going forward, and it was a great way to introduce black actors and have people of color in this story, which otherwise would have been completely white, because it's about the 60s, the 50s and the 60s. In this particular situation, it would have been all white people. So that's one thing. I thought that was really great, like the idea, like, you know, it doesn't matter, the actor can play whoever. But now we get to this Nina Simone thing where it's like, you cast Zoe Saldana, who is a light-skinned Afro-Latina woman. Nina Simone was a dark-skinned black woman. What is the responsibility of everyone here? So are we saying that, like, you know, I don't know. Are we saying, like, we needed to get, like, a dark-skinned black woman to play Nina Simone? Or can that role for other people? So, yes.
You know why? This is the thing. I don't mind colorblind casting, right? Because in some ways, this is what's happening with something like Hamilton, right?
I was going to bring up Hamilton next. Hamilton. That was my next point.
That's the next point, but the reason why I think it's particularly troubling here, and see, this is why I don't want us to make whole swath conclusions about one or two or three or four or five instances, but Nina Simone's very struggle was because of her skin color, her hair, and her lips. She was rejected for the very thing that they are now attempting to redo in the story, in the telling of her story. That's the problem with the casting. The problem with the casting is the content. You could take a light-skinned boy and make him play James Brown. That didn't seem to be his issue. But this was a central part of her own racist struggle when she wanted to be a classical musician. She was rejected for those things explicitly. They said that to her. So to take her story and then essentially cast the very person who would have been chosen above her. It just undercuts the entire project. It undercuts her entire storyline. And that's why, so that's the part of it. It's really just about being kind of sensitive to the story you're telling. And so that's the part of it I'm just kind of like, I just reject.
So, well, I guess Viola Davis was unavailable.
or many of the darker skin actresses that have now emerged who probably can actually have a space to talk about that, because Viola explicitly talks about her skin color being problematic and him being actually mentioned by people.
Well, talking about the content of the story that you're telling, a couple of months ago there was a huge flap about Idris Elba because people were floating that he should play James Bond, mm-hmm. and the author of James Bond was like, well, no, either, I don't remember the quote, it was either Idris Elba is not British enough, or the author made the assertion that James Bond is British, therefore a black person cannot play him. Sure. And everyone was up in arms about this. So, I mean, James Bond was written to be a white person, because at the time that story was written, a black person could not have played that role. But now we've moved on. So James Bond's going to be around with us for a very long time, probably. And so that part will always go to white actors, and that's just going to be the way that it is.
I'm fine with people saying... Okay, go ahead, Jason. You say. Make your point.
Well, I just... You know, the James Bond thing is, to me, I just reject that logic. First of all, the creator of James Bond is dead for a long time. And other authors have then taken it up. And who gets to decide whether this totally fictitious character is ever black in a movie? No one should be able to decide that. Like, it's just, to me, it's just silly. It's like, it's a fictional character. And again, I think in this particular movie about Nina Simone, I just totally agree with what you said, Tricia, that just because of the subject matter, because of what her life was like, of what she stood for, what she went through, we're replicating in making a movie about her that's supposed to celebrate her, we're replicating the kind of, discrimination might be too strong a word, but preferencing that she went through. And just the other thing I'll say is, it reminds me of, I don't know if you remember this, when Malcolm X, the movie, mm-hmm. was first in production, Norman Jewison was the director working on it.
And that's someone's last name.
Oh yeah, he's made several prominent.
Yeah,
wow. I've never heard of him before.
But yeah, I mean, even yeah, you hear his last name and you're like, wait a second, like something is wrong here, right? Like something is wrong with this picture. Eventually, he after a long time abandoned the project, and Spike Lee did it. And I mean, I don't have super strong feelings, but it was kind of like, yeah, like. It shouldn't, you know, I'm a white Jew. It shouldn't necessarily be a white Jew directing this movie. You know, like Malcolm X stood for black people kind of owning their own means of production. And yeah, Spike Lee or a black, you know, socially conscious director, you know, is the right person to direct that film. And I think that this is a similar, I feel the same way about this.
You know, this is somehow related. And so... maybe the way I introduced it in terms of kind of the more salacious aspect, which is the blackface thing, was probably a misdirection. Because I also recently saw the Jesse Owens story. I was not present. But
Jesse Owens was the athlete?
The athlete who won 4 gold medals in the Nazi Olympics.
Beat the Nazis.
Yeah, he beat the Nazis. The
Nazi white supremacism.
The Nazi Olympics is what's going on with Trump right now, by the way.
Yeah, it's the Nazi Olympics. But what was really problematic in this film, the woman who made all of the Nazi films, you know, Triumph of the Will and all of those films. So they decided to, since they cast a woman in the part, I mean, since they cast this white woman and she was beautiful, I guess they needed to make her heroic in some way. And then it was... you just could tell that it was this bizarre, sanitized version of racism. The way that those stories like to talk about racism, as if it's a kind of thing that happened, that was past and done, and it's not integrated in the story. It's just the weirdest thing. And I remember leaving the story, looking at who had put it together, and going, no black person was behind the scene with this. And it's just, sometimes I think, and this is going to sound so harsh, but this is part of the issue. It's like we live in a white supremacist culture. If you're not particularly critical of that culture or understand that, then you can't sort of deal with the victims of that culture in a useful way in storytelling. I mean, I think that's the limitation. So I actually don't have a problem with people saying things about Bond like James Bond cannot be black, because James Bond is the height of white supremacist culture. So let him be represented fully by a white male, because that's actually part and parcel of him. Part and parcel of James Bond for me is his whiteness, is his sort of like complete disregard for the cultures that he invades and does whatever the hell he wants.
Come on, Trisha.
No, but that's part of it, right? He represents the British Empire. That's fully what that's about. So his whiteness is part of that. And I would dare say that's okay. It's part of the content of the story, not just the form. And so that's my issue with a lot of these things, is that it's not about just about should we cast a black person, should we cast a white person. No, it's like, what's the content of this person's life?
Okay,
what's the content of the story they're telling?
So now pivot quickly for the point you just made. Pivot quickly and explain Hamilton to me then.
Well, Hamilton is interesting, because what's happened with Hamilton is that because these people have now been deified, they are no longer human, right? And so what has to happen in some ways in terms of creative storytelling is you have to shift people's perspective on them so that they become human again. One of the first ways that you do that then is changing up the audience's expectation. Is creating parallels that where the audience wouldn't have seen it before. And so now what you do is you've created this contemporary space where you can have a dialogue about historical characters. Because it's not entirely clear that Alexander Hamilton was 100% white. He was born in the Caribbean. His parentage is somewhat dubious.
Have you two seen Hamilton?
No, we've just...
No,
just,
I haven't gotten around to it yet.
Can we
is
all
it like
get
it,
in?
It takes like 10 years to go
to
see it.
Yeah, I mean, to buy tickets, really, but you can just roll down there and win the lottery.
That's the only way you can.
They only have to call your name once. It's great if you live here.
So I haven't seen Hamilton, but I think everything you're saying is valid, Trisha, but I would go a step further to say my understanding, having not seen it, is that part of it, so, I mean, this is, stay with me for a second. So Stanford and the Sun.
I'm out.
The sitcom.
Hold on. No, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sanford and Son, the sitcom, you know, was based on a British sitcom with white characters, but white working class characters. Mm-hmm. And when they adapted it, my understanding is that the thought was, well, this, you know, the kind of Cockney culture in England, like, what's the corollary of that in the United States and from a class perspective? Mm-hmm. And they came up with, well, it's, you know, it's working class African Americans. And that seemed to work to some extent. My understanding about Hamilton is part of it is an effort to say, to show just how counterculture, so to speak.
Yes, they were.
The kind of patriots were. Mm-hmm. Like, how do we show that? It would be like black activists who, like, you know, rap and rise up. And I think that, so I think that there's some significance there to, you know, to contextualize it, to really relay to the audience how radical these people were. Hip hop culture was like the best answer to that. That's my understanding.
It's kind of like adaptation. I think it's very interesting. Book and we watch the film and we talk about that. And one of the key questions that asks is, what's the essence of the story? Right? And I think sometimes when you play with casting, you can actually get to the essence of the story. Right? So it's like in something like Hamilton, by going against type, you've subverted this narrative in an interesting way so that you can actually see it in a new way. Right?
But you're saying that can't work in the Nina Simone way.
Because it actually supports the very thing that Nina Simone was fighting against. So it sort of doesn't serve the larger theme or even the content of her life. Like, usually when you're talking about characters or actors or whatever, that's more form, right? It's not even sometimes content. But this way, the form is a part of the content.
So are you, both of you, mm-hmm. so are you, well, Trisha first, are you saying you're okay with her prosthetic nose and the darkening of her skin, you're okay with it, but not for this story. The content of the story should prohibit that.
Yes, because the content is if Nina had her druthers, she couldn't change those very things about herself to make herself accepted. So in some sense, you've got to pick the actress who can inhabit that space fully in her big lips, in her darkness, in all of those things. Now, I don't know. Maybe putting all those prosthetic and all that stuff is going to make people hyper aware of that on the screen. Maybe that could also work for the story. I don't know. It just feels really... I don't know. It just doesn't
I'm just,
seem to
I'm
work
trying to
for
think
me.
Of a corollary where they would, like, darken an actress to have her play a part. I'm trying to figure a corollary where that happens or that could happen. And I would be okay with it.
The funny thing is, you know, for example, Meryl Streep had a prosthetic nose to play a Room of Her Own writer. What's her name?
The one who wrote
Miss Virginia Woolf. But, you know, that was just more like an audience look thing, right? But the fact
well,
that you have
that's
to,
what Virginia Woolf looked like.
Yeah, and you wanted her to look like her. But, you know, I'm not even a slave to the people needing to look like them. But what I'm talking about is, it's like, you know what it would be? The corollary is, in some weird way, is if somebody has been rejected for being fat and then they cast a thin actress and tell her to put on a fat suit. You have fat actresses who've probably been rejected. Just use someone who's going to bring that to the table. You know what I mean? I don't know. Maybe this is also a larger issue of, like, trans, you know, like what happened with the trans actress in that recent film where she won for the Independent Spirit Award. Mm-hmm. Like, there's so few parts for trans. Why not just give it to a trans person? You know, why does your need to be an artist trumps the fact that we have actual trans artists who rarely get roles, so here's a part. Give it to a trans person. Like, I also think practically as well. Do you know what I mean? It's like...
Interesting. I.
You seem. What is going on here? This is interesting.
Because I can detect a slippery slope here.
Sure, you can.
And I'm trying to figure out.
There is a slippery slope.
I'm trying to figure out where my footing is. Because I agree with what you're saying about the content. I understand that sort of like the casting and the prosthetics and the darkening is like a very slap in the face to the actual Nina Simone. I get that. But then I'm trying to think of another, like if this was, and I'm just riffing here, but if there was like, say, a lighthearted romantic comedy about sub-Saharan Africa, and Zoe Saldana was cast, and the lightness of her skin and the texture of her hair would be very uncommon in sub-Saharan Africa, so they darkened her skin and they did all this stuff, I'm wondering how I would feel about that. And then I pivot my thought to like, well, I can think about that about Zoe Saldana, but what if they got Jennifer Lawrence and then they darkened her skin and changed her hair? How would I feel about that? And I'm like, well that's wrong.
Wait, this happened though. This happened. Okay. Robert Downey Jr. in, what was it, Tropic Thunder?
Yeah, everyone keeps saying it, yeah. But that was kind of like a broad
was a joke. It was like
thing,
a satire.
Right?
That was the whole point of that. That's about content again.
Yeah, the content of darkening his skin was the point.
That was the whole point they were trying to make. That was the joke, and it was like it was an incisive one. It was cute, you know. But so that's not a strict. That's not exactly what I'm talking about. But do you see where I'm saying the slippery slope there? Like if it wasn't about the content, if it was just a character who was described as dark skin, and Zoe Saldana is the best fit. We darken her skin. Am I okay with that? Let's say that I am. Well, then I'm not okay with Jennifer Lawrence taking that part. What if she's the best actress for that part, except for the skin thing?
Except the part is for a black person. Come on, we're not going to go there now.
Well, okay, but wait a minute. I'm casting a comedy about sub-Saharan Africa, Zoe Saldana isn't the part either.
Why not? She looks closer to it than anybody than Jennifer Lawrence.
So is that what we're talking about then? It's like degrees of how close you look to the character.
There's no slope. Because I already told you I have no problem with darkening skin or doing any of those things. I have no problems with that. We've done that in other movies. We've given them wigs. We've taken hair off. I have no problem with that.
Jennifer Lawrence.
No, I mean, with Jennifer Lawrence, that's just blackface. That's just dumb. But what I'm talking about is, in this situation, I'm talking to you about... It's like, for example, I'm going to cast a movie with a woman, but I found a possibility that this person could have been a man, so I'm going to get a prosthetic penis. I'm not talking about those kinds of things. I mean, come on. Like, there's no slip. What I'm saying is that people have to be mindful about the content of the story they're telling. You know... Just like I didn't reject the James Bond thing because I think that James Bond is a white character. I mean, people are going to balk at that, but he is white. His very whiteness is how he negotiates the world that way. Just like his very maleness is the reason why he negotiates the world the way he does. I have people who say, "Oh, wouldn't it be fun if James Bond was a woman?" I'm like, "No, it really wouldn't because
that would be a different story."
Yeah, James Bond is a misogynist. I mean, unless you want to cast a movie with a misogynistic woman.
Wow.
I mean, you know?
James Bond is getting up in this conversation.
No, but I just think that sometimes we have to talk about the content of what our stories are about. We sort of flirt around them all the time, but this is a moment where you just have to say to yourself, what's the story about? This story is really partially about the tragedy of this woman's life based on how she looked. So we don't get to play with that part of it.
I see it a little differently. I do think there's a slippery slope in the sense that, like, for you to say, you know, Jennifer Lawrence, no, because she's not black, but Zoe's closer to sub-Saharan, like, that is a slippery slope. So that it's like, what about Jennifer Lopez, right? Like, you know, like,
they do that already. They all do it. They do as common practice.
Wait, Trisha, wait. Jason, go ahead. I see where you're going. Go ahead, Jason.
Thanks for being the referee. No, so what I was going to say is the part of it, I mean, where you and I agree completely, Trisha, is on the Nina Simone story, the content. It's kind of like affirmative action. Like, it just does make a difference that the lighter skin you are, whether you're white or black, you're getting more work. And so when there is a part that could be played by a dark-skinned person, a dark-skinned black person, for instance, I'd like to see the role go to that person because so often the fame and the fortune and the work goes to lighter skinned people. So that's my own opinion about that. The other thing though I wanted to say is, and I'm disagreeing with you, Tricia, on the James Bond thing, because I am all for taking characters, even ones that are steeped in white supremacism or imperialism, and then appropriating them differently. I mean, in some ways, again, Hamilton, you could say that's being done. I think about, and this is a totally different issue, but, you know, when T.H. White wrote The Once and Future King, which was taking the King Arthur legend for hundreds and hundreds of years, you know, I mean, still white, still English, you know, all that, but his King Arthur was like basically a pacifist who was trying to end war. Well, that is not the King Arthur of 1400 years ago, but he was looking at World War II and trying to make a case that, like, we needed to find a different way from everyone killing each other. And I'm all for that. Like, someone saying, like, let's make Idris Elba James Bond and change that character, because it's a fictional character, from, you know, an agent, a champion of white imperialism, to something different, whatever that may be. I don't know. I'm all for that. I see no problem with it.
I mean, I see no problem with it, but it's not – It's just a different interpretation of James Bond. That just highlights sure. what the white James Bond was.
Yeah, agreed.
But see, in people's minds, they just want to take Idris Elba and stick him in there with no sort of reconnection.
Well, okay.
They don't, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, that's a
they
good
just,
point.
You know
that
what I mean? They really
problem.
Just they just really want they just want a hot black guy in the same role doing the exact same thing. they don't want to use it as an opportunity to tell a different type of story. They really don't. They simply want Idris Elba to that's be rolling around on the floor with hot ladies. And shooting.
So that is a bad.
You know what I mean? I mean, they just want a hot guy with dark skin. This
okay,
time.
I want to ask another question, because this mm-hmm. I'm reminded of a conversation that I had with a teenager last year. And this teenager was very she was very passionate about LGBT rights.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we were having a conversation about trans actors and trans parts. And I think she was making the point that, I don't remember what movie or show we were talking about, but there's part about a trans person was played by a cisgendered actor, and she was very upset about it, and saying how we should make every effort to do X, Y, and Z and make sure all that matches up. And, you know, I was cautious in talking to her because I was like, okay, well, just like I'm cautious in this conversation because I feel a slippery slope. So then I asked her, I said, have you seen the show Fresh Off the Boat? And she says, I love that show. And I said, did you know the guy who plays the father, Randall Park, is of Korean descent? And in the show, he's the head of a Chinese-American family. So how do you feel about that? And she's like, well, he looks the part. And I said, I'm sorry. What do you mean? He's not Chinese. And he looks Korean. So, and she's like, and I was like, well, so what you're saying is because he's close enough, right?
Yes.
To the point where you can't tell, because you're not intimately acquainted with how Korean people look different from Chinese people, that's good enough for you.
Sure.
Now, but okay, but do you see where that has like a place in the conversation we're having right now? Like, this is where the slope exists. Who gets to make the decisions about who can play what part? Now, I think we can all sort of agree that because of white supremacy, a lot of people of color had not had access to certain roles and certain parts and careers and livelihoods, and so we try to correct that. But I don't know if I want to be the person who's like, okay, the part for African Queen, we have Zoe Saldana and Jennifer Lopez and Jennifer Lawrence. Let's get out a paper bag and do the paper bag test. Like, I don't want to be that guy. I don't know how we resolve that. And I mean, I want to put to bed the Nina Simone thing, because I think we all agree that the content of that is very powerful and should be respected. But, like, you know, through our discussion, we've come to this other thing that I'm not really comfortable with, which is that, you know, we can darken Zoe Saldana to play a role, but Jennifer Lawrence, that's just blackface, that's just stupid. I know there's an historical context to blackface, and that's why we all, I think, are reacting so viscerally to Jennifer Lawrence being done up as an African woman. But I want to suggest that J-Lo or Zoe Saldana are also completely incorrect for that part, and darkening them is in some way just as bad. Some way.
Well, of course. Nobody denies that. I don't think that's a disagreement.
Oh, it's not?
No.
All right, well, then, hell, let's move on. All
right. We ended with consensus. It's beautiful.
No, you know what?
No, I misunderstood that.
No, no, no.
I misunderstood your point.
No, that's no, no. Fine. We ended with Jason's point, though, which I think is very fair, which is that the art is happening within a cultural landscape that has also real impact on people's, on economies, right, of actors. And so whenever possible, because we know that you're not going to get 10 trans part per year, you're not. Okay. It's just not going to happen. So we have to put those things into consideration. And so when you have a chance to cast a trans actor or actress, do it. Because they're not going to be that many, and you know you're not going to be able to make them play the other part. It's just not, it's not happening.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that those are the tension, right? Those are the tension that you have to kind of juggle.
We've been talking about this for a long time, and we have to move on.
Okay.
I would love to revisit this again sometime. I think when I've had more time to think, I think we should all go to our corners and think about this, because I think a lot about diversity, or maybe a better word would be equity, in Hollywood, in entertainment. Yep. I think a lot about it, and I don't know. I'm not always certain like which angle to come in achieving that equity.
Yeah.
You know, I think a lot of it is like telling different stories. You know,
exactly.
I think the problem why we don't have a lot of parts for black actors is it's not about telling white stories or black stories. It's when you tell different stories, we're sort of hamstrung by the idea that whenever we make a historical drama, if it's more than 40 years in the past, then it's going to be a lot of white people. I think we just need to get out of out of that thinking. Let's move on. I'm kind of tempted to skip my topic altogether and move directly to recommendations. And here's why. My topic will be, do I have a topic? the Oscars happened recently. And Chris Rock hosted them. I guess I've been so upset about it all week, and I've been, like, ranting to anyone. I spent an entire morning on Facebook just responding to everyone who critiqued the Chris Rock monologue one way or another. Like, I just had a lot of feelings about it to the point where I'm, like, exhausted by it. So I'm going to present a little bit, and I'm going to ask you guys to riff, all right? So Chris Rock had his monologue. Did you guys watch the Oscars, first of all?
No.
No, but I went back and watched the monologue and many other parts online afterwards.
So I read his monologue, and I watched some clips from here and there of his comedy. And I have to say, I don't offend easily, but I found that a lot of the things, what went on at Oscars night on that stage, I found parts of it were very offensive. And I want to say that I like Chris Rock a lot. I think he, by all accounts, he seems to be a great person to work with. He's a very, very funny man. I do think, though, that audience matters. And I know everyone had these expectations, like because of all the controversy around Oscars So White, I knew the expectations were very high that he was going to really skewer Hollywood and really make the point to them. But that just feels like really myopic. Like how all those people in that audience showed up to celebrate the very institution that is controversial. So they all knew going in that there were no people of color being nominated for Oscars. And they're all kind of tacitly okay with that, right? Because they participate in this entire charade. And so when Chris Rock took the stage and sort of dug into them about it, it was really, I don't know how the white people in the audience felt, but it must have been really uncomfortable. And what's more, it just seems kind of besides the point. Like, you're up there telling jokes, and we're laughing about how white the Oscars are and how parts don't go to black people, and we're all belly laughing about that while celebrating that at the same time. I thought it was confusing. And last part, then I'll shut up. I want to get reactions from you two. The part when he said, you know, Oscars have been around for a long time. You've only but given away a few Oscars to black people. This has been going on for a very long time. How come people weren't protesting in the 50s and 60s? Oh, because there were real things to protest back then. You had to worry about if you were going to get raped or lynched.
And they applauded. They applauded when he said that.
Some of the most applause out of the monologue. It was the people were cheering, woo! Like that sort of thing.
And
when I read it, and then I went back and watched it be delivered. I still can't, a week later, articulate my feeling that I felt when I heard the applause and cheering about that. I'm not certain the point that Chris Rock was trying to make. I'm not certain how it was received. I'm not certain what that reaction was about, but I know it left me deeply disturbed. I just felt like the whole thing was a miss for him. He would have done better if he just didn't show up. You guys?
Well, I do want to talk a little bit more about that part in particular, because that was in my mind as the most disturbing part. And I remember, and I can't remember which of his movies, I find Chris Rock usually to be both hilarious and very skilled at bringing up tough issues and pushing people's thinking on them. So I'm a huge fan of his. And I can remember in one of his movies where he is talking to an almost entirely black audience, and he says something like, the most racist people in the world are old black men because they remember when there was real racism, not this can't get a cab shit. And I totally agree with you, Chris, about audience.
See, math. That's funny. I'm laughing. It's funny.
I totally agree. But also, he's saying it to a black audience. And I think that there's something very significant there. Like, not that it's okay that black men can't get cabs, but just that, like, you know, just putting certain things in perspective. But to say what he said to a white – I mean, basically, to me, what he was saying is this really isn't that big of a deal. And they're all applauding because it was like, oh, thank God the black host said it. We're not really that racist. And that – I totally agree with you. He said some other, I thought, very good, valid things. And that really undermined the message. And, like, I wanted to hear more of, like, no, this is a big fucking deal. It's absurd. It's absurd. Hollywood is absurd in how racist and white supremacist it still is to this day. And to say, like, well, this isn't real racism, which is what he was kind of saying, I was just – I still think he's great. I think it was a misstep, but that was I was very disappointed.
I was blown away. Trisha?
I mean, I can't really go here with y'all because, like I said, I didn't watch it. I didn't even go watch his monologue. Because, you know what? I mean, I think if you're going to really reject something, you've got to reject it outright. You got to reject its premise. You got to reject the execution of it. You gotta reject all of it. So you can't make it palatable. You know, it's like you can't say this person is a real racist, but kind of a nice guy. I mean, we're making claims about that institution, and yet we're supposed to show up and put on a pretty face and participate with that institution. And you know, that was some of those were some of the reasons that people gave for showing up in the first place, right? People showed up and said, you know, we all have to work on multiple battlegrounds, and you know, there were lots of black nominees. There were not nominees because that didn't happen. There were lots of black presenters who were brought forward to let us know that actually black people do exist in Hollywood, even though they won't be getting any awards or being nominated, but they were there to kind of put a face on it. And I just thought that, I mean, I understand how punitive the industry is. So the fact that they actually all had to show up says as much as you need to know about that industry.
That the black actors had to show up to present.
They had to show up. Because if they didn't show up, they would have been punished even more so.
So you think Jada and Spike and Will Smith are all going to be punished?
Well, first of all, Spike is already punished. He can barely get money to make his movies anymore.
Spike's been punished for 30 years, I feel like.
Yeah, for 30 years, kind of sort of telling a type of story. And I think Will be punished in some dealings. Because remember, and it's fine for him to be punished, though, because he's not the number one box office star anymore. It's not as easy to forgive him now. Back in the day, he could do no wrong because he was still bringing people to the theater. Mm-hmm. Now that he's not doing it that much, there's really no incentive for them to go above and beyond whatever makes them uncomfortable to seek him out for parts. And Jada has really only ever done TV lately. So, I mean, and her show is hit or miss, you know? She's now back. I guess she was killed off, and now she's back. So I do think they'll feel the sting of that. And I think anyone else who had said anything outwardly would have felt the sting, which in some sense confirms what we're talking about already. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think for me, I didn't want to participate in it. I understand that they needed to, and I understand that that's, you know, that's their industry, and they've got to fight the good fight within the industry. But I felt like as an audience member, the power I had in that moment was just to not participate at all. Was to essentially say, until you change the room, I'm not going to watch your movies. I'm not going to support your movies. I'm not even going to tweet. I didn't do anything. I did a completely different thing while the Oscars was going on. While the Oscars was going on, I was watching the Justice for Flint concert. And tweeting about that and trying to raise awareness about that at the same time.
Good for you.
I just think that we have to start doing that more. And not in a sort of like self-aggrandizing way, right? But it's just like we just got to put our money where our mouth is because the industry is all about that. And to be honest, to come full circle, I just saw a quote this morning from Les Moonves, right? The president of CBS. Oh, what did he say? Mm-hmm. He said, Donald Trump might not be good for America, but he's certainly good for CBS. And those are always going to be the choices people are making. It's not good for America that we can't see people of color being nominated. And I say people of color because I do mean people of color. Because one of the fucking weird things that emerged out of this was actually a battle lines being drawn by folks of color. Because really, in some sense, Chris Rock actually really, he really pushed some envelope in one direction, but then also pushed people back because there were the anti-Asian jokes. There was this real sense that this was really a black and white issue that people left the Oscars feeling. So it wasn't very unifying even for people of color. You know, so, I mean, it did more harm than good for a lot of reasons, I think. So I don't know. I said earlier to Chris that I lobbied for the fact that I think a show like this should be as blazingly obviously out of touch as possible by simply getting Hugh Jackman to do song and dance numbers and just be who they're going to be and then let the audience reject them.
I am kind of on board with that, especially after the absolute fail that was Chris Rock and his comedy. And you can't see it, but I'm putting air quotes around the comedy. I found what he did so offensive. Just briefly, I just want to describe the Stacey Dash moment and when he brought the three Asian kids out on stage. So,
brutal.
It just, the Stacey Dash thing, I felt like my head was exploding. So, Chris Rock in his joke, air quotes, says, oh, and introducing the new director of diversity, Stacey Dash, which gets a couple of groans from the audience. But then Stacey Dash walks out onto stage, and no one knows what to say or where to.
Who doesn't even belong there because she's a TV actress? Let's be practical, even.
Stacey Dash walks out on stage, and she's got like this weird Batman villain giggle, and she looks at us and goes, "Happy Black History Month!"
Ooh,
and no one knows where to go. And then she goes backstage, and I think you hear some titters. I think some people laugh, some people applaud. I could not wrap my mind around why this was a good idea. Stacey Dash has gone on record saying she doesn't think Black History Month is useful. She doesn't think BET is useful. She doesn't think black spaces are useful. So for in a year where the spotlight is on how sort of racist Hollywood can be, how dispassionate and disinterested they are in people of color and stories of color, in that year, for them to bring out a black person who agrees with that and then make a joke about Black it History on stage, Month. To make a joke about Black History Month during Black History Month in front of people who, as I already said, on some level are already disinterested in black people and black stories, like the inceptionness, like the levels of bullshit there, like it was bullshit inside of bullshit. It was minstrelism inside of minstrelism. I couldn't deal. I could not deal. And then really briefly. Really quick, because I want to finish talking about this. Really briefly, he brought the three Asian kids on stage and make a joke about, oh, this is going to be counting the votes, and also about it's who's going to be making your iPhones. But and so, and of course, people laughed at that. They laughed at these children on stage. Although the rich, powerful white people in the audience laughed about Asian child labor, it just blew my mind. It was too much. Audience matters. Sorry, Jason. Yep. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Well, I was just going to say the piece that I did like was I saw online Chris Rock interviewing people at the Compton Movie Theater. Oh, and I really liked that part. And one of the people, you know, one of the bits he did is he would hand an interviewee an actual Oscar and say to, like, make a speech. And one of the guys, African-American guy, you know, coming out of the movie theater, you know, he said, I just want to say that Hollywood's not recognizing enough Hispanic actors, enough Asian actors. And so even though, you know, I agree Chris Rock didn't go there, that whole segment with the interviews I thought was very good. It showed how out of touch Hollywood is, broadly speaking. And I thought that some of the interviewees were actually, like, really insightful.
Yeah, because it's not a black or white issue. Like, Asian Americans are never, ever in movies.
But you know, it's interesting. I remember reading when this issue came up earlier in the year, I actually read a piece about how there is actually room, we're coming full circle, there's actually room for sort of Republican-like folks to find space in this Oscar so white issue, because they did talk about the fact that in some ways the Oscars also does a really poor job of celebrating working class. And also sort of like Appalachian people. I mean, like, real parts of very distinct parts of America just gets left out. There's a kind of bizarre middle space that Hollywood movies are just always about. And they're the exact same type of people, regardless of even the ethnicity. They're just the same typology of story. Right. And so there is a kind of fundamental lack of diversity even in the root of the story they tell about white people. So it's sort of like the same white people story too. And then, yes, they like to reward it when it's like a really gritty white person, right? So it's like, oh, it's like a really, really like Norma Jean kind of thing, or Norma Ray kind of thing.
Norma Ray. Yeah,
the Norma Ray thing, right? So it's like, so there is really like multi-layers of just a lack of diversity of storytelling, period. But ultimately, at the end of the day, I mean, I think Hollywood responds to money. And so Chris Rock showing up essentially reaffirmed the value of the show anyway. By participating in it and giving the audience a space to kind of even get their lashings from him, it just became a part of the very ugliness of the whole thing. You know? So it's sort of weird. But because I don't even know, why would I want to go to an award show where I'm going to basically be chastised? That's the thing. It's not even really a celebration. I'm going to be chastised. So that sort of self-flagellation that they were willing to put themselves through as well was also weird.
But also, the fact that you're going shows that you accept your invulnerability to that chastisement.
Yes,
it?
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
So, like, oh, I'm going to the Oscars. I'm, like, all dressed up and going, knowing everything that's going on. Like, so while you're on stage skewering me,
Yeah.
Like, I'm giggling because I have all my parts. I'm about to win an award. Like,
and I'm going to, and nothing's right. going to change tomorrow.
And I will ensure that nothing changes because I want to win more awards.
Like, the silliness of it all.
The silliness of people like, well, you know, they didn't nominate any black people, but Chris Rock is going to stick it to them.
Stick it to where? He just simply collected a check and said, thank you very much. I mean, not that there was anything wrong with what he did, but I'm just saying it's like, it all became part of the show and it didn't really mean anything.
No, I agree. And what would have been stronger, I mean, I'm kind of reminded of Frederick Douglass's July 4th speech when he starts out and his tone is very much like, thank you so much for this opportunity. You're all lovely white people that are amazing for having me as a black person in the 1860s here. And then he truly, without humor, makes a very impassioned speech about how they are not doing nearly enough to ensure that African Americans become equal citizens in the United States. And you know, my sense, I don't know the history that well, but it seemed like they invited him to be this gracious, you know, grateful black man that that they're willing to celebrate. And he was kind of like, fuck you guys, you're not doing enough. Now, if Chris Rock had done that, like if he had come in and said, I'm going to do a monologue where I truly, mic drop, chastise you, drop the mic, and then like, oh shit, what do we do? The host walked off the set. That would have been effective.
Yeah,
that would have been epic.
Because you know what? Then it pulls you out of the moment. It takes you away from business as usual. Because how do you continue to say this is wrong, but then continue to have a party? It's like, you know, it's like, I mean, honestly, it's like the movie that wins, that won, Spotlight. I mean, it's like the Catholic Church is like, I want you to believe that we really, really, really care about your children. But yeah, guess what? We're going to keep on molesting them. And
yeah, they care about them all right.
You know what I mean? So it's like, it's just like the incongruity of it was too much for me. And so I just decided I just couldn't participate. I was like, I can't. I don't know what to do about this, but I can't. Not anymore. So, I mean, good for him, though. Glad he got a paycheck. I mean, I think a lot of people just tuned into the beginning and then stopped. They had their lowest rating in years.
Oh, is that right? I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I 8 years, I think. And I think it's just like, it's just an anachronistic thing, and it should just die.
I hate the Oscars.
Very painful death.
As I said horrible. On Facebook, even if the race was not an issue, I think it's such a stupid concept.
It's such a dumb concept. I'm going to compare these four.
The race is central
categories.
To it, though, right? But I think race and racism is central to the idea of the Oscars, because of all the movies that get made all over the world, it's only these few movies that are selected. And there's real reasons behind that. And so, like, you can't excise race from what's happening there. You know, I've become more disturbed. I've become more disturbed over time about how many movies we watch that have British people in it. British everywhere.
British and Australian.
British everywhere. Australian. And now that I've begun traveling the world a lot, I realize that, like, a lot of people, like, in the world are neither British nor Australian.
Nope.
Imagine my shock. But
in islands.
I know.
Low populations. Why are they in all of our movies?
In a country where we are neither British nor Australian, I just am always surprised by like how many British and Australian accents we hear, like almost on the daily. It's kind of weird. Think of it. Let that sink in.
And isn't it weird that they're the only ones that are winning awards? They're the only ones.
Yeah.
They're the only ones that are good. They're just good.
No,
Everyone else just isn't.
You almost wonder, you know, South Korea, like the government sponsors like schools to like create pop bands. You almost wonder, like, do these countries have like secret schools? Like, we're gonna take over the American, you know, film industry and win all the awards. Like, what is in the water in Australia that they come and like act better than all of our actors? I don't get it.
You know what it is, though? It's actually not even...
They're just really white.
And they're just new. And also, there's the idea, too, that they kind of... I mean, especially the men, there's an idea about them holding a sense of masculinity that has been lost in America. So there's this sort of ethos around them as sort of brawny men who are, like, uncultured and bring a sort of authenticity to the space, which is a mythical... It's a mythical authenticity, but it's one that they really celebrate. Just like how, you know... when they cast movies and they're looking for somebody who's actually Latin, they end up picking like an Italian because that's what that's what they want, an Italian. They want a Latina to look like an Italian, so they're just going to do that. It's the same thing. I mean, the whole thing is really a constructed space. But what's amazing about it is how much that constructed space is now a space that we just accept as a given. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is what this is what the world needs to look like. And Americans don't even look like them, so they have to go someplace to find someone to play an American because they've successfully cast. You know what I mean? They've actually successfully moved away from casting Americans to play Americans because the idea of an American is not who they see. It's strange. So even among the white actors, they are going someplace else to find the person to play the part. And that should be egregious to them.
That's
no.
true. Well, that's actually very interesting.
Perhaps, but it wouldn't be egregious. It's a different kind of thing. You know, but this is why,
Well, I mean, in some sense, they were just as much a victim of, like, the Donna Reed mystique, right? And that whole idea of what white feminism looked like. So it's like you can create a false god, and then you have to subjugate yourself to it. They've done it too.
All right. Well, this has been the longest conversation in the history of the world.
You can break it up. That's what's great about it, right?
So let's quickly hit on recommendations. Some kind of media, whether it be a book, article, TV show, movie, really great tweet that you saw. That you saw, listened to, or experienced that you think other people should see, listen to, or experience. What has been that media event for you this week, Trisha?
Well, I really wish I could. I really wish you we'd been able to do this now. I don't think it's actually available anymore. But the concert for Flint was actually really great, and it was on Revolt TV. I don't know. Immediately afterwards, they were looping it for 24 hours, so you can see all the performers. Stevie Wonder showed up, Janelle Monáe showed up, and they interwove it with stories from people, from the victims in Flint, and talking about the things that they were experiencing. So if that's still available and you do a search for it on Revolt TV and it's there, totally watch it. But otherwise, if it's not, I just I read the book Between the World and Me with by Ta-Nehisi Coates, and a friend just told me that she bought the audio version and he read it. So it was read by the author, and she just found
it
to be
I
think
that's
great. I mean, to be able to hear him say the words, because words are so powerful and well chosen in the book, so I know the way he emphasized important. So I'm just going to recommend that. I think that's got to be a great thing.
All right. Jason?
Before I give mine...
Oh, God. Why is there a preamble? What the hell is this? Could this be easier, Jason?
I just want to respond quickly to what Trisha said. Am I allowed... Like, I think Ta-Nehisi Coates is, like, absolutely brilliant. I love that he's from Baltimore. Case for Reparations was unbelievable. I have not read the whole book, Between the World and Me, but I've read excerpts, heard lots of interviews. Can I say for a moment, though, the genre of people writing letters or essays or books to their sons, starting way back with, like, Benjamin Franklin, and it may be before him.
Sure.
It seems I'm always a little off-put by, like, do you want to write something to your son? Shouldn't you write it to your son? Like, is his son saying, like, you know, Dad, I really wish you hadn't shared this with the whole world. I felt really special that you wrote 400 pages.
Oh, stop
to me.
It.
So anyway, that's not mine, though.
That's great.
So
that's a great
way. I'm not allowed to say that. I'm not allowed to.
That was terrible. I'm cutting that part out.
My mind, real quick, is that I discovered this podcast called Myths and Legends, which this one guy reads, like, he goes back and researches, like, the origins of famous myths and legends and then tells the story as it was originally conceived. And I am totally into it, and it's just extraordinary how different some of these stories are from the way that we think of them now. I'm totally hooked.
Oh, sweet.
Can you just give us a really super quick example?
Yeah.
Can you give us a super quick example?
Well, Aladdin. So I always knew Aladdin actually took place in China, even though it was written in 1001 Nights, which is an Arab text. But, you know, the genie there are two genies. They don't grant wishes.
What?
You know,
fundamental.
Yeah, it's exactly. There's no flying carpet. I mean, it's just it's so interesting how different it is, and it was really good. But it's like, oh my God, we've changed this thing.
It's great that the story has changed through time like that.
It's unbelievable. It's amazing. What about you, Chris?
See, I had a lot of trouble this week because, like, I was so riled up by the Oscars. I read a lot of history of the Oscars and, like, Oscar stuff. I think that there's this one thing. You may be familiar with The Onion. Mm-hmm. The Onion has diversified in recent years, and now they have, like, spinoffs. Like, they have a division called Clickhole, which is sort of like where The Onion takes on newspapers, Clickhole takes on BuzzFeed and those sorts of things. And so they have a new one called Starwipe, which takes on like celebrity news. And I'll post this. I posted on Facebook. I'll post it somewhere. Starwipe did it was sort of like hilarious GIFs of white people laughing at Chris Rock's Oscars. And it was like Oscar jokes. And it was all like pictures of them like guffawing while being quote unquote skewered, which was exactly my point. Have you guys seen it? I put on my Facebook wall. If you haven't seen it, I'm gonna link you both to it. No,
I've
you have gifts. To. I'm gonna link you both to it at the end of this. I want you to see it, and then we're gonna. What are your reactions? But it's hilarious because it's just it kind of gets to my point, which is like the ridiculousness of really taking these people to task. You know, at their
at their million dollar party.
Yeah, at their $1 million party.
Oh, that's man, like, it's savage. Like
having, it's like having a stripper show up to a bachelor party and be like, I'm going to talk to you guys about feminism. Hey, my eyes are up here. Like, what? How do you smile at all? Well, I mean, I guess I'm recommending that particular link on Starwipe. I don't really have a media event. Like I said, I was like
that's
totally
great.
That's a great recommendation.
What's funny is that I was overcome by the Oscars event I didn't even watch.
I know.
Yay. We all honor our boycott. I'm proud of us.
I do want to say for the record, for the media record, I did watch Deadpool this week, which is a movie that is ripping up the box office.
Is it good?
Was it good?
You can't apparently not because you didn't recommend it.
I reserve my comments for possibly a future topic.
Oh, good.
I will say, but the TLDR of it was that I thought it was mediocre. People across America will think it is the fucking second coming of comedy, much the way they thought Book of Mormon was on Broadway, while I blinked my way through it. But whatever.
So it's like a Trump movie.
Well, it's if you know a 14-year-old, take them to see Deadpool. They'll laugh their ass off.
Mm.
Yeah. But okay, so this has been a very successful and very long episode. And so the only thing left to do is to say good night. Good night, everybody. Thank you, guys. Bye. See you next time.